Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, where we feature community conversations around South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel throughout our community and listen to local groups discuss what matters to them. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Ammon Swenson. Today's show features speakers from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation's 2026 Economic Luncheon. We'll start off with Mayor Suzanne LaFrance with updates on the city, followed by AEDC's President and CEO John Bittner with the Anchorage Business Survey and the Economic Report. We'll then hear from keynote speaker Federal Reserve Board Governor Lisa D. Cook. The program concludes with a panel discussion about Anchorage's fiscal future. This program was recorded on August 5th and was edited for broadcast. Here's Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for having me here today, and thank you to John Bittner and the entire AEDC team for bringing us together today. So thanks to all of you for all that you do in your professional and business everyday work, and for what you do for our community. In municipal government, it's easy to spend all of our time and our energy focused on solving problems or anticipating the next bump in the road. And while we do face some real problems, and that drive to solve them is vital in the work that we do, we also have to take a step back and look at the bigger picture. And it's important to recognize and celebrate progress. So today I want to highlight some of the momentum that we're seeing across our community right now. Because when you stop to look, that momentum is clear. Progress is happening. We are making change together, all of us. And Anchorage is going places. As you can see, there's incredible energy and investment happening across our community. And this truly is a huge team effort. Right now, public projects are laying the groundwork for revitalization and long-term economic growth and resiliency. Construction, as you saw, is officially underway on a refreshed Town Square Park. Paratrovich Park is ramping up, and we are on track to start renovations this fall on the historic City Hall building for a new downtown library branch. We're improving connectivity of our world-class trail system by building the Ship Creek Trail connector on the coastal trail, investing directly in the public spaces that make Anchorage a place people want to live, work, and visit. Down at the port, construction on our new cargo terminal is moving forward. This isn't just a local project, it's critical infrastructure for Alaska's economic resilience, serving 90% of our state with incoming goods. And some of you may have heard and maybe even felt the pile driving that's going on at the port. Through our Beyond the Beige grants and ACDA partnerships, we're brightening neighborhoods from downtown to Muldoon to South Anchorage with new murals and streetscape upgrades. When local government leads with infrastructure and quality of life investments, the private sector steps up with confidence. We're seeing vital commercial and housing investments across the bowl, from the redevelopment of the Westmark Hotel here downtown to FedEx expanding its footprint at the airport. Our permit center reports that so far this year, we've almost surpassed the total number of new housing units permitted last year, and it's only August. Our healthcare sector is expanding rapidly. Major projects by South Central Foundation, ANMC, and Chugach Alaska Corporation's Village in the City demonstrate deep commitment and long-term vision for our region. On base, J-Bear's expansion as a primary defense hub is bringing billions in federal investment to Anchorage. This creates massive opportunities for Alaska Native corporations and local contractors to bid on major design and construction, driving jobs, payroll, and steady growth right into our local economy. Public infrastructure, healthcare, housing, tourism, national defense, and local business. Nearly every sector is leaning in. At the municipality, there are only so many levers that we can pull to boost our local economy, but we're doing everything we can to bring public investment to the table, open the throttle on housing, and prepare our community for tomorrow. Every dollar invested today is a vote of confidence in Anchorage's future. We're facing some big issues, like energy challenges, which my team is tackling through planning for a waste energy plant, conducting an energy audit, and adding more solar panels. We have plenty of work ahead, but our foundation is strong, our trajectory is clear, and we should all be proud of the community that we are building together. I look forward to hearing the detailed economic data from Mr. Bittner, as well as insights from today's keynote speaker, Lisa Cook, as well as the Community Leader Roundtable. Thank you all so much. It's an honor to be here with you today, and let's keep Anchorage moving forward.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. So I'm equal parts excited and terrified to move us to the next portion of our event, my presentation of the AEDC 2026 Anchorage Economic Trends. Over the last decade, Anchorage has gone through three distinct economic phases, each of which have had a measurable impact on our community and our economy. The first economic era was the recent oil price recession. Oil prices dropped to 70% around a decade ago, and Anchorage lost 6,400 jobs over a five-year period. We went from 157,000 jobs in 2015 to 151,000 jobs in 2019. Consumer confidence fell as well, from the low 60s to the high 40s in the same time period, and Anchorage's population went from an all-time high in 2013 of 301,000 people to about 289,000 people in the same time period. Right on the heels of this recession, we went into the second phase of the economy, COVID. It was a shorter but more severe impact on our total economy. Total jobs in Anchorage went from 151,000 to 139,000 in 1 year. That's a 12,000 job drop in a single calendar year, the single largest drop in the data set that we looked at by far. And during that time period, consumer confidence dropped as well. We went from the high 40s of the oil recession down to the lowest marker that the index had ever recorded, 40.1. And that brings us to where we are today, sort of this recovery period from 2022 to today. And it took us the last 5 years to basically make up the ground we lost in that 1 year in 2020 by gaining another 12,000 jobs. So we're basically, from a jobs perspective, back where we were pre-COVID, but still under where we were at the end of the, or at the beginning of the oil recession in 2015. The important thing to note here, though, is that consumer confidence didn't recover with the jobs. We're still about at 40.5 today, which is only a fraction of a point above where we were at the height of COVID. And that's something interesting to note, because it means that the consumer confidence did not keep pace with the economic growth that we were seeing. So another thing to note is that the five-year stretch of job growth seems to be falling off in 2026. We're still adding jobs, but we're adding it at a slower pace than over the last 4 years or 5 years, and that seems to be indicative, or it could be indicative, of a slowdown in this recovery. So, to sum things up, we went from an oil recession to a COVID pandemic to a partial recovery in 10 years. It's been a bit of an economic roller coaster. But there's some nuances to how this has been happening and the implications they have on our economy today that we should probably dig into a little bit more if we want to understand where the economy is going and what we should be focusing on in order to support that growth. So for those of you thinking the last 5 years haven't felt much like a recovery, this next slide probably explains why. This shows the percent change in total jobs by industry over the last 10 years. As you can see, oil and gas is the biggest drop here. It's down 52%. Retail trade is down 17%. Professional services is down 11%, and government is down 5%. Even tourism, leisure and hospitality is down 2%, but good luck getting a hotel room this summer. It's not all bad news, though. Construction's up slightly, almost 4%. Healthcare has grown 13%, and transportation, warehouse, and utilities is absolutely dominating the job growth chart at 29%. Way to go, Ted Stevens International Airport and Don Young Port of Alaska. Maybe we should name some more things after politicians. The important thing to note here is that the makeup of Anchorage's economy is changing. We're losing ground in industries that have traditionally been strong as a result of Anchorage being the financial and retail center of the state, and we're moving more into a logistics and healthcare-focused economy with added construction growth thrown in on top of that. But underneath all of this, there's a demographic story, and it actually might be more important than the job story that I just told you. And that's a tough thing to say as an economic developer, because usually there's nothing more important to us than jobs, but in this sense, I feel like it's worth noting. Net migration in Anchorage has been negative in 15 of the last 16 years. And that's not driven by a short-term event like COVID or a recession. That's a structural pattern. And the exodus has been in a very specific subset of people. Our working age population in Anchorage is down 9% since 2015. That's a steeper decline than the state as a whole over the same time period, which is down 6.2%. Anchorage's working age population decline represents roughly 66% of the total working age job losses statewide over the last decade, even though we only make up 40% of the population. And over the last 5 years, Anchorage's portion of the total jobs in the state has dropped every year from 2020 to today. One of the interesting contrary patterns here is that Anchorage's younger workforce actually bucked the migration loss trends between 2020 and 2025. And these are the younger members of this working demographic. During that time period, Anchorage actually added growth in those demographic ages while the state lost ground. So one of the things that we really want to focus on here is, as these younger workers come to Anchorage, focusing on A, what brought them here, B, how do we keep them here, and C, how do we get more of them, is going to be a crucial part of the story on how we turn that population migration around. One of the overarching trends here that I do want to call attention to, and the reason we're comparing Anchorage to Alaska in terms of population and jobs and other aspects, is that what we're seeing is Anchorage is recovering post-pandemic, post-recession. Alaska is recovering post-pandemic, post-recession. But the recovery and the migration losses are not recovering at the same pace. The state is actually recovering faster than Anchorage. So whereas the city has recovered almost all, you know, the city has recovered up to about we're still down 3.4% in jobs lost since COVID, whereas the state is only down 0.5%. So we're both making ground up, but we're making ground slower than the rest of the state. Population migration, same thing. We're losing people, but the rest of the state isn't quite losing them at the same rate. And this shows a difference in the recovery that seems to be based on local factors. Something in Anchorage is holding us back from this economic recovery overall. And this larger population pattern isn't lost on the Anchorage business community. 51.5% of the businesses surveyed in our 2026 Anchorage Business Survey cited availability of labor as a barrier to growth, and 37% said population outmigration was a barrier. The bottom line is it's extremely difficult to support economic growth in a community with a shrinking, aging workforce where more people leave than arrive. It's the root cause behind almost every other issue that we're going to talk about in this presentation. So how does that all feel to the average Anchorage resident? Well, our friends over at Anchorage Survey Research track that exact sentiment every quarter through their Consumer Confidence Index, and the answer is not great. As I mentioned before, the CCI currently sits at 40.5, basically less than half a point above where it was at the height of the COVID pandemic. But unlike during the COVID pandemic, where it was pretty easy to figure out why people were unhappy with how things were going, the reasons for the negativity here are a little less clear. As I mentioned, we've gained 12,000 jobs over the last 5 years. The mayor mentioned a number of new developments across the city. There's billions of dollars coming into the military. There's all sorts of activity and action that are going in our community, and we still have a level of negativity that is disproportionate to that recovery. What's particularly interesting is the disconnect between people's perception of their personal finances versus their perception of the economy as the whole. So when asked how they felt about their personal financial situation, the confidence level was 56, an extremely robust number. But when asked what their confidence was in the local economy, the index was only 42.5. This is reflected in the business community as well. We asked a similar question in the 2026 business survey, and over 70% of businesses said that they thought their business would do as well or better in 2027 than they did in 2026. And 50% of the businesses surveyed said that they were expecting growth during that year, adding jobs, adding new services, expanding into new markets. When we asked them what their biggest barrier to growth was, though, 54% of them said the local economy. That's a pretty big disconnect. How can you say that your personal finances are going well and are going to get better, your business is doing well and it's going to expand, but that your perception of how the economy is doing as a whole and how the community is doing as a whole are that negative? One of the working theories we have is that this isn't necessarily an economic problem. It's a perception problem among individuals and businesses. When it comes to topics they're intimately familiar with, their own finances or the financial situation of their business, their perceptions align with the overall economic data pretty well. The further from the areas of expertise, though, the more they rely on external sources. And the problem with that is most modern communications, aka social media, they prioritize and incentivize posts and communication that inspire two things, anger and fear. A post about a cute puppy dog doesn't nearly go as viral as a post of somebody doing something mean to a cute puppy dog. And the same logic applies to posts about the economy, the community, and other social ills. We high grade out the negative in these communication channels, and it's starting to reflect itself in the way we view the future of the economy and the future of the city. Because of the overall recovery, people and businesses aren't panicking. They're actually feeling pretty good on a personal and individual level. But their broader community confidence is definitely scraping the floor due to these online influence perspectives. And that's important because perception about the future drives spending decisions, drives optimism about the future, drives choices in investing in the community, and it drives public conversations about the city that we live in that influences people's decisions to move to and stay in Anchorage. Not all of the negative sentiment can be explained by social media algorithms, though. Some of that negativity is probably driven by costs. Anchorage's cost of living index sits at 127.9. That's up from 122.8 in 2024, a 5% jump in a single year. That means that average costs in Anchorage are about 28% higher than the index's average of 250 communities. That makes us the 18th most expensive city in this list of communities across the nation who participate. It also means our costs are comparable to Honolulu, New York, San Francisco, and other major urban centers. That's not really a club we want to be a part of. This means that we're asking people to move to or stay in a place with a shrinking population, a flattening job growth curve, and rising costs. And that combination is likely why you saw the demographic slide you just saw keep trending the wrong way. But it's not enough to just look at the raw data and guess how the trends are impacting Anchorage's businesses. We needed to go out and get direct feedback from the business community itself. This is Anchorage. We're still the largest city in the state. We're the hub of logistics, finance, healthcare, government, education, and more. And it's important that we understand the implications of the long-term trends on our businesses in their own words. That's exactly why we conducted the Anchorage Business Survey again this year, to hear exactly why businesses chose Anchorage and what they need to help what they need from us to help grow. One of the things we were most interested in was what business owners thought, what was standing in their way. When we gave businesses a series of choices to pick from, the answers boiled down to two things: people and politics. The state economy, the local economy, availability of labor, out-migration, political uncertainty, housing affordability, and the cost of labor were the top barriers to business in that order. Notice what isn't on that list, even though they were options: taxes, regulations, operating costs, etc. The barriers all relate to overall community conditions and labor, or are driven by them. These are choices that we make as a community on what we invest in and what we don't invest in. When we opened up the survey and let businesses write in their own words, no multiple choice, just give us your straight thoughts, one topic came up more than any other, and it was by a wide margin: homelessness and downtown conditions. 24% of all of the open-ended comments in the survey, no matter what the topic was, referenced these two topics. The next highest issue wasn't even close. Public safety was rated as very important to business success by 79% of the respondents in a fixed choice question, the single highest rating in the survey. And 60% supported reducing homelessness as a municipal priority. But there's even more underneath that. Another 20% of respondents separately raised downtown conditions, vagrancy, and visible drug and alcohol use in public spaces as major issues that needed addressing. Combine all of these things together and the visible state of downtown and the unhoused population were the single largest themes of the entire open-ended data set. They were ahead of taxes, ahead of workforce, ahead of housing, ahead of education, all the things that we normally talk about in these types of surveys. This may be hard to believe after what I've talked about up till now, but despite all of that, there's still a massive amount of optimism and love for this community among the business community. And there's a belief that operating a business in Anchorage is a significant competitive advantage. While I normally try to avoid confirmation bias, I was extremely happy to note that what businesses loved about doing business here is the same thing I love about living here. It's the community. 25% of the businesses responded to the tight-knit relationship-driven culture here as the top competitive advantage the city has. Many businesses even pointed out that that culture of mutual assistance and support even extended to their competitors. Not surprisingly, another 20% pointed to the city's role as a logistics hub and a population hub for the state, specifically citing the Ted Stevens Airport and the Don Young Port of Alaska as huge opportunities and resources. And about 12% pointed to access to people, the ability to make long-term relationships with others, the ability to secure a mentor, the ability to access higher level of people in an organization than you would in any other city as a major benefit to doing business in Anchorage. Again, reinforcing the community level feedback. That optimism and love of community is what we're going to need to build on to affect the change we need to grow. And what's more community-minded than taxes? Am I right? One of the last things we asked businesses were the options for diversifying government revenues, both at a state and a local level. I want to give a quick shout out to Assembly members Anna Browley and Aaron Baldwin Day. They've been doing a phenomenal job of going around and educating the business community, community leaders, and others on both the limitations of municipal funding as well as the drivers for municipal budget expenses at this point and what that means for long-term infrastructure development and investment. When we asked about taxes in 2025, we got very general responses. Businesses were open to some kind of sales tax, maybe a bond. They weren't really sure what it would look like, but they knew that we needed to invest in the community to grow. In 2026, the depth of thought they put into it had obviously changed. Businesses were proposing very specific forms of tax, sales taxes, excise taxes, or income taxes on the state level. While some of them, I think, may not survive a legal challenge, it does indicate an overall sophistication in their thoughts on this matter, and as well as their focus on it to boot. Basically, they recognize that the municipality and the state need to explore new revenue options to provide funding for the core services that they say are key to their business success. And that includes homelessness, public safety, housing, education, and more. They also have fairly detailed ideas on what form that new revenue should take. Now, I'm not going to do a deep dive into the various ideas that they proposed in this presentation. I will call out a few high-level thoughts. The top choices were what I like to call the Chilkoot Charlie tax model, and this is take money from the other guy and pass the savings on to you. Now, specifically, the other guy in this situation are tourists and out-of-state workers. But underlying that in a close second is a belief that sales tax on a state and a local level are a viable option to diversify our revenue. Income tax on the state level did show up as a third choice in there as well, but not as strongly as the sales tax. When it came to the PFD dividend, there was support for a reduced dividend to fund state services, but not for a complete elimination of the dividend altogether, at least not as strongly. And last but not least, we also asked for an open-ended thought on just generally what they thought about revenue diversification, taxes, and municipal and state spending. And one of the things that really came through in this was, while there was a broad-based agreement that we did need to invest in ourselves to be the community we wanted, we need to invest in our infrastructure and these core services, before they were willing to entertain that, businesses pretty universally said they needed to be assured that the money that was already being spent was being used wisely and efficiently, and the new money that was being raised would go towards the key issues that they were concerned about, namely public safety, housing, roads, et cetera. The short version here is that businesses want solutions to the problems they perceive in the community, and they're willing to entertain new taxes to fund them, provided that they are assured that the money is being used to the best possible effect to address these barriers to business that currently exist. So what does this all mean for the future? I want to close out the data portion of my presentation with a look at the next 3 years, basically. And we're going to focus on six areas that we think represent the big areas for change or growth in Anchorage here between now and 2029. And these six areas are military, housing, energy, healthcare, government, and logistics. Huge thank you to Alyssa Rodriguez and Economic Development Consultants. She helped us put together this forward-looking forecast. She does phenomenal work. The biggest economic driver over the next 3 years is going to be the upcoming military investment in J-Bear. The $2 billion the mayor mentioned that's proposed in FY27 and the additional $6 billion that's going to follow that are going to be used for a variety of construction and expansion projects on the base. And this is in addition to the $3 billion that's already been spent over the last 3 years. And that was for runway extensions and other improvements. Additionally, they're going to get an increase in the personnel on base, 26 to 2,800 new active duty members along with their families. And this is going to mean a huge impact on all of the job sectors that we talked about here to date. Everything from construction to professional services to retail. This is going to impact the entire city in a way that very few other things have in recent years. But of course, that brings us to housing. The mayor launched her 10,000 houses in 10 years program to address the existing deficit in housing that Anchorage has, but this is an additional 2,000 to 3,000 housing units that we're going to need by 2030 to support the service members that won't live on base. And that's going to be a huge increase in the amount of houses we're going to have to build over the next 3 years. That's going to mean a huge increase in the number of construction workers, developable areas, investment in housing, and all these things that go along with increasing the housing numbers in Anchorage. It's a difficult problem, but it is something that we are going to have to address if we're going to take advantage of this economic opportunity that's coming our way in the short term. Obviously, healthcare is going to continue to grow and serve as a key part of Anchorage's economic recovery. New investments in medical facilities, senior care, behavioral health centers, and more are coming to Anchorage, and they're going to add even more jobs than healthcare already does. This has been a growth industry across the last 10 years, regardless of COVID, regardless of recessions. It has been a wonderful shining star in our economic portfolio for a very long time. And I think that's only going to continue to grow. We talked about the aging population, and that population is going to need more and more medical services as they age, and that's going to require more nurses, more senior living homes, all these things that are going to increase the job profile. And of course, logistics is forecast to continue to lead the state in growth and investment in Anchorage. The Ted Stevens Airport moving to the number one cargo hub in the nation, the port modernization project entering into phase two, the continued growth in our air passenger numbers and Anchorage's importance to the growing e-commerce logistics all point to a continued period of growth and investment in this sector over the next 3 years and beyond. When it comes to energy, however, things are a little less positive. I'm sure all of you saw the news about the potential natural gas shortages this winter that might require us to cut back on our energy usage, possibly even resulting in brownouts or more. This is a significant problem that Anchorage and the state of Alaska have to address as quickly as they possibly can. Whether it's through additional natural gas out of Cook Inlet, shipping in liquid natural gas through the port, adding the natural gas pipeline for the North Slope, all of these have difficulties in implementation, but we have to find some solution to provide sustainable, reasonably priced energy to Alaskans and their businesses in order to grow as an economy and survive as a community. Last but certainly not least is government. Alaska and Anchorage both receive a significant amount of federal funding and have a significant portion of their workforce in government agencies, particularly in federal agencies. Now, over the last 10 years, those numbers have contracted across both local, state, and federal numbers. And in the last year alone, particularly in the federal government sector, I just read an ADN article today that said that Alaska had the third highest reduction in federal workers in the entire nation. We're losing jobs at a prodigious rate, largely through early retirement offers, but also through contraction of grants and programs that have traditionally, serviced Alaskans all over the state for quite some time. Now, the federal funding that we're losing is being offset somewhat by the JBEAR funding that's coming in, but again, it's not necessarily a one-to-one comparison. We have to find a way to make sure that these government jobs are transitioning back into the private sector workforce and not leaving the state. And we also have to recognize that the more these sectors contract, the more difficult that it is for us to have the services that we're looking for, permitting, public safety, education, all of these things rely on government employees to provide those services, and they've all been identified by the business community as top criteria for what they need in order to succeed. But in order to facilitate growth, in order to take advantage of the opportunities that are coming, and in order to be the community that we need to be in order to welcome people in as opposed to seeing people leave, we need to come together and create a city that can accommodate new investments, economic recovery, and population growth. And in order to do that, we need a plan. So AEDC, in partnership with the Municipality of Anchorage, is launching the Community Economic Development Strategy, aka the CEDS program, right here, right now. This is going to be a citywide effort to bring together as many businesses, nonprofits, community leaders, and individuals around the concept that Anchorage is an amazing city full of opportunities, quality of life, economic growth potential, and vibrancy. It's a city worth fighting for, worth investing in, and worth bragging about to anyone that you run into. Over the next 6 months, AEDC and the amazing CEDS Leadership Committee you see here, whose members represent the major economic sectors of the city, are going to embark on a series of roundtables, areas of focus, engagements, and assembly district informational sessions. We're not just going to collect more data or fixate on what folks don't like about the city. We're going to collect passionate, engaged people and creative and achievable ideas that are going to change this community for the better. And we're going to use it to craft a 5-year strategic vision for Anchorage that we're going to spend the next half decade implementing, along with all the partners that we can bring along with us. We're going to change the narrative on what this city is and show people that the true strength of Alaska's largest city is in its small town community vibes and our shared belief in what this place can do if it puts its mind to it. We're going to build action groups around housing, public safety, commercial development, transportation, JBEAR integration, and more, collaborating with all of the amazing people and organizations that are already active in these spaces, many of which have booths out there in the lobby. We're also going to attract new voices to the conversation, bring in people that currently aren't in a part of the discussion so that we can get new ideas and fresh energy behind these longstanding problems. We're going to help supercharge all of these efforts with staff support, advocacy, convening, funding, and more. I think we all recognize at this point that individually, no one organization can make meaningful change on some of these more intractable and longstanding issues holding our city's growth back. But together, we can and have done amazing things. Through our survey, we've already asked for businesses to step up and help us with this SEDS program, and over 250 of the 300 businesses that took the survey said that, yes, I want to be a part of this, I want to help you out. I genuinely believe that with the economic conditions the way they are, with the community engagement the way it is, with the amount of activity and the mountains that this community has overcome in the past, there is no reason to believe that we cannot build the community that will be attractive not only to the people that live here and our children, but to people outside of Alaska looking for exciting new adventure and economic opportunity for themselves. Thank you so much for listening to this. I promise all the other speeches you're going to hear today are going to be a lot more upbeat than this one. Now it is my absolute pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker today. Lisa D. Cook is a governor of the Federal Reserve Board. She is an expert in so many things, it's not even funny, I can't list them all. But she is a phenomenal resource for us. We are very, very lucky to have her. And I cannot say enough good things. I'm excited to hear what she has to say. Please help me welcome Governor Lisa D. Cook to the stage.
Thank you, John, for that kind introduction. It's an honor to be here in Alaska. As many of you know, I have spent the majority of my career as an academic economist and professor. I have a deep, longstanding love for data and information. At the Federal Reserve, I have had the privilege to have the best and most timely data at my fingertips. Yet there's no substitute for the information researchers and policymakers can gain from real-world interactions. This is the main reason I am delighted to be here today. Not only to share my own view of how I see the economy developing, and just as importantly, to hear from all of you and to learn about how monetary policy affects your lives, careers, businesses here in Alaska. And I'm always looking for an opportunity to get out of Washington, D.C. Specifically, today I would like to share my economic outlook for the U.S. and then drill down a bit further to discuss what the data tell me about Alaska's economy. Finally, I would like to focus on one type of data I watch closely and that John alluded to, consumer sentiment data. I view the U.S. economy as remaining resilient and growing at a solid pace. Inflation continues to be stubbornly high and has exceeded the Federal Open Market Committee's 2% target for the past 5 years. Meanwhile, the labor market appears to be stable in a low-hire, low-fire environment. Thinking first of the price stability side of our mandate, my assessment is simple. Inflation is just too high. This has been my long-held view, and I have noted that inflation has moved significantly away from our target over the past year. The inflation picture improved modestly in June, the most recent month for which we have data. However, I would not put too much weight on one single data point, especially in what remains a highly uncertain environment. The Personal Consumption and Expenditure Survey, or PCE Price Index, rose 3.7% in the 12 months through June. That is nearly double our target. Elevated energy prices due to the conflict in the Middle East have contributed significantly to inflation over the past year. But it is not the only factor. Core prices, which exclude food and energy costs, rose 3.3% over the same period. This year has brought two unexpected sources of inflation pressure. The Middle East conflict has driven the cost of energy and certain other goods higher, and companies are ramping up capital spending to build out AI infrastructure. That investment wave has lifted prices for semiconductors, high-tech equipment, software, and utilities. Taken together, these developments have shifted the balance of risks toward inflation and away from the labor market. On the other side of the dual mandate, the labor market has remained resilient over the past year. In June, the unemployment rate was 4.2%. That rate has barely changed from a year earlier, and is consistent with what many economists believe is the natural rate of unemployment. Job growth over the past year has been modest. However, it picked up in the spring months, averaging more than 100,000 jobs added per month, from April through June. Although the hiring rate is low, the unemployment rate remains steady because layoffs are low. Initial claims from unemployment benefits have trended at historically low levels for several years. The low hire, low fire equilibrium hit some groups, including new entrants, especially hard, and may constrain worker sentiment for good reason. Several factors could explain why employers are not hiring as many as they did in the recent past, including longer-term structural shifts, pandemic-era overhiring, or increased work from home. However, international and state-level data suggests that low hiring rates, when they reflect slow population growth, do not signal an impending downturn by themselves. At the same time, many workers understandably worry about how AI will affect their livelihood. Thus far, the most dire predictions about AI job losses have not materialized. I still see this development as a significant risk, but one that has not grown over the past year. Overall, economic growth in the U.S. remained solid this year. After being adjusted for inflation, output grew 1.8%. through the first half of the year and is on track to grow at a faster pace in the second half. An important driver of those gains is the AI-related investment I previously mentioned. Overall, business investment rose at a 10% annual rate in the first half of the year. Meanwhile, U.S. households appear resilient, with consumer spending advancing at close to a 2% rate in the first half. Housing continued to be a soft spot, with the level of residential investment edging down about 3%. What does this outlook mean for monetary policy? As I have described, inflation is too high. And I consider the risks to the inflation side of the dual mandate higher than the risks to the employment side at this point. As such, I am prepared to act by raising rates if necessary. The labor market and output growth are currently stable. I would consider how a rate increase would negatively affect that stability. Still, I would support an increase if it becomes necessary to bring inflation down. It may not. Some disinflationary forces are already in play, which could push inflation toward our target without a rate increase. Allow me to describe these forces. First, the effects of tariffs announced last year on the price level are mostly behind us. Even though those tariffs account for a lot of the elevated inflation seen in 12-month changes, they may no longer provide much inflationary push going forward. We should see some disinflation as the early months of tariff pass-through drop out of our inflation window. However, the exact path of tariff policy remains uncertain. Second, while oil prices continue to be elevated relative to early this year because of the Middle East conflict, many forecasters suggest they will come down by the end of the year, providing some deflationary relief. However, similar to tariff policy, uncertainty remains high. Third and finally, some of the recent price increases in goods is due to the relative demand shift from the AI build-out, as demand for chips especially has led to stark price increases in high-tech electronics. As supply chains adjust and sector-specific efficiency gains accrue, I believe some of the inflationary pressure coming from the AI build-out will ease. For these three reasons, I felt it was appropriate not to change rates while we observe how these factors evolve. If I do not see signs of continued disinflation soon, I am prepared to act. With 5 years of above-target inflation, the risk grows that higher inflation may become entrenched in price and wage-setting behavior, leading to persistence that would be much harder for us to attack. The longer inflation is above target, the more likely this scenario becomes. Thus, while we might be able to afford to wait for longer in a different environment, we do not have that luxury in this one. When I consider monetary policy, I focus on the national picture, as I just described. But I know the economy varies from state to state, from city to city, and neighborhood to neighborhood. The Alaskan economy has some similarities, with and some differences from what I see in the lower 48 states. Like the rest of the country, Alaskans have faced substantial increases in the cost of living since the pandemic, and inflation pressure appears to be picking up in the most recent readings. These price increases are likely weighing heavily on Alaskan households, who historically have faced higher prices than other Americans, particularly in remote areas of the state. The labor market here appears to be stable, as it is in much of the country. The unemployment rate is low in Alaska, just 4.4%, according to the BLS. In fact, this lower level is the lowest of any reading published before the pandemic. Initial unemployment insurance claims are also low, suggesting layoffs are low. Employment in the healthcare sector has been a driver of overall job gains for several years in the state. Meanwhile, federal government employment, which constitutes a higher share of the Alaskan workforce relative to most states, has declined notably this past year. As you know, Alaska is facing a shrinking labor force and an aging population. Alaska's working age population, those aged between 18 and 64, declined slightly in 2025, as John alluded to earlier. Simultaneously, the number of Alaskans aged 65 or older increased 3.2% last year. One major difference between the Alaskan economy and that of most states is the large share of the economy that is attributed to the oil and gas sector. Employment in this sector, which stood at 9,700 in June, has largely moderated over the past decade, although the sector added a significant number of jobs in the past 12 months. When energy prices fluctuate, as we have seen in recent months, Alaska faces an economic dynamic that no other state experiences to the same degree. When oil prices rise, your state's government fiscal position strengthens. At the same time, many Alaskans, particularly those in rural areas, see their energy costs spike. Therefore, the state's balance sheet improves while household budgets in remote areas feel real strain. This dynamic is something I want to hear more about, but as an outside observer, this creates a natural tension in how different parts of Alaska's economy experience the same price movement. Certainly, this is something we need to keep in mind when we think about energy price volatility and its broader economic effects. Before I conclude, I would like to discuss a disconnect I have observed when examining economic data. The discussions I have had here and around the country reveal that many workers and business leaders have a less favorable outlook on the economy than official statistics indicate. Like the Anchorage data John mentioned, national consumer sentiment data bear out this observation. Consumer sentiment, by many measures, is lower than one would expect in a solid labor market, and perceptions of job availability have continued to worsen. In outreach calls, I hear that vulnerable households are especially dissatisfied with the economy. It is important to understand what is driving low sentiment to ensure that the FOMC is doing what it can to best achieve our dual mandate. I've come to the view that households are currently reporting low sentiment for three main reasons. First, the introduction of AI has raised uncertainty about the job market. Many Americans see the benefit of AI, but are also concerned about the labor market transition. They wonder whether in coming years jobs will be available for themselves and their families, which seems understandable. Although the labor market has been resilient, the hiring rate is low, which disproportionately affects young entrants. Moreover, some evidence suggests that hiring in certain AI-vulnerable sectors may have slowed. Second, decades-long structural changes present challenges for today's middle-class families. Most notably, housing costs have increased sharply for both home buyers and renters. These increases have far surpassed wage gains in almost every region of the country. In Alaska, house prices have increased fivefold since 1990, more than double the rise of the overall price index for all goods and services. In addition, nationally, the cost of education, health care, elder care, and child care has risen more than wages. Household debt has risen, and intergenerational mobility has declined. These trends may interact with other macroeconomic changes in ways that make them especially painful now. For instance, young adults today compete for housing and jobs with older, wealthier baby boomers, making these longstanding challenges more acute. Finally, the third reason I point to as an explanation for weak sentiment is the high inflation experienced over the past 5 years. This high inflation also interacts with the longstanding trends I just mentioned. The extended bout of inflation would have called attention to the corrosive rise in real prices of housing, child care, and education that occurred over decades. In sum, the reasons for low sentiment are real and deeply concerning. They require a varied and broad policy approach, largely outside the scope of monetary policy. But we have our part to play. As a monetary policymaker, I believe that the best thing we can do in our roles is to ensure that inflation returns to and stays at target. If you take one thing away from this talk, I hope it will be that I am firmly committed to restoring price stability. It would be a pop quiz if I were back on campus. Bringing inflation back down to target, first and most importantly, is critical to achieving the dual mandate that Congress assigned to the Fed. Achieving our goal will also bring much-needed relief to families who have faced elevated price pressures for far too long. And achieving price stability will help narrow the disconnect that many Alaskans and many Americans feel when they assess their personal, less sanguine expectations for the economy relative to solid, more sanguine readings for growth and development. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I look forward to continuing to hear and learn from workers, families, and business leaders here in Alaska. Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and introduce our panel. To my immediate right here is Deborah Barini, CEO of Providence Alaska, Dr. Cheryl Seemers, Chancellor of the University of Alaska Anchorage, followed by Curtis McQueen, Executive Director of the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association, and last but certainly not least, Colonel Stefan Pulasic, Deputy Joint Base Commander at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Colonel Pulasic, I want to talk a little bit about how J-Bear is a huge economic driver for the city, and as well as the fact that the personnel and the dependents located there make up about 10% of the city's population. There's also been a lot of activity. We talked about it in the previous presentations, the $3 billion over the last 3 years, the $8 billion that's coming. Can you talk a little bit about some of the ways that the base is a key part of the city's economy and what you see as opportunities for more collaboration?
So you mentioned it a few times, the previous investment, the $400 million runway project that'll complete at the end of this year, a big local firm completing that project, as well as a joint integrated test and training center. That's another $350 million building alone without the equipment going into it. So huge growth with that. The economic impact that we had in our study from last year was $4.1 billion for Alaska and the local economy based on the 40,000 folks that work and live on J-Bear. So a huge boom, like you said, a little bit over 10%. We'd be the second largest municipality in Alaska behind Anchorage if you rolled up all the folks that work and call J-Bear home. So we look forward to that. And with the opportunity, projected 2,500 homes short of fulfilling our need by 2030, and that's around $85 million a year in rental income or mortgage payments. That's just from our tax-free housing allowance that comes in annually, and with the projected growth, that's about $116 million of income. That doesn't include property tax, utilities, and all the other investments. So a lot of signs in growth. What you've seen in the news with the $2 billion next year for investment, and then $7 billion from the Air Force alone does not include the Army investment, which is another $3 billion over the next 5 years of military construction projects. So huge numbers. We're projecting $10 to $15 billion between now and 2032. So no shortage of construction equipment and folks moving to the area.
Deb, I want to talk a little bit about how Providence has been investing in primary, preventative, and behavioral health care and express care as well. What's sort of driving those investments, and what kind of impact has that been having on healthcare providers across the city?
When we talk about some of the work we've been doing and the investments we've been making, it's really about, I think, a challenge that all the employers in the room would understand. When you're looking at providing healthcare for your employees, you're challenged with the same thing we as Providence are challenged with, rising healthcare costs and providing really excellent care. And so the investments we've been making have been centered around addressing just that. When I was very early in my career, I was actually shadowing with a caregiver, and I met a psychiatrist, and he said to me, "You know, Deb, every time we admit a patient to a hospital, it's a failure to keep that patient well in the community." And so if you think about that lens and you think about the investments we are making, those investments we are making in our community are about keeping people well in the community. So you've seen us expanding primary care and urgent care and express care within our community, and behavioral health care, which is primary care for our community, so that we can keep people well in the community and meet them where they're at, manage healthcare conditions before they escalate and end up in an emergency room visit or a hospital visit.
Dr. Seemers, UAA is the largest workforce generator in the state, and your student enrollment often serves as a kind of bellwether for the state of the job market in general. Can you tell us a little bit about your growth that you've seen in student enrollment and what you see coming in the future that's on a university level that's going to impact the economy?
I would kick off by saying the workforce question is a question that we address together, always. When I look around the room, I see so many partners who are investing in the university and people who are coming to the table for a conversation. Even this panel, as I look across, conversations at JBEAR with Providence, with Alaska Airlines, asking two questions: what are the most pressing needs in workforce for our state, and how can we help? That's fundamental to every question we're asking. We have tons of innovation at the university. And I would be remiss if I didn't say it's all levels, all ages, all people bringing diverse perspectives to the table to make great things happen. I myself am a 30-plus year Alaskan, and I know one thing. We work together to make great things move forward. And that's maybe back to the community comment, why we like being here, why we actually like connecting with one another to solve problems. But for the University of Alaska Anchorage, our age of student is trending lower. Average age used to be around 26, 28. Our average age right now is 22. We are seeing the greatest growth in our APS scholars coming into our programs. We're seeing improvement in high school students who are converting and staying in state. Isn't that exciting for all of us? That's amazing. But with that, I would say, here's our challenge. The job market has been explained in Governor Cook's remarks, in CEO Bittner's, as competitive. And our students know it's competitive, and they are approaching it cautiously. That's the most used word. So what can we do as a city to help? I think it is a reciprocal relationship in this way. We tend to hire people who are experienced and who have already have experience on their resumes. Students know that. They also know that those entry-level positions are at threat with AI and the changing climate we have around that. So they are cautious. As a university, we're pressing into experiential education. How can we get our students in your businesses early? How can we get them in the job market, making connections that Alaska is so known for? Because if they do, they find jobs and they stay. So know that we brought three tables of people with us today. We have deans, we have advancement, we have athletics. They would love to talk to you afterwards about how we can connect and answer that question, how we could help. But I'd end by saying the more we can get our students into workplaces, we already boast that 85% of our students stay in state. That's pretty amazing when they graduate. And our numbers for graduation are good and trending upward all the time. So I would end with that. There's optimism and energy. despite the headwinds that we've talked about and the headwinds for higher education in general. Good future outlook.
Curtis, I wanted to ask you a little bit. I mean, Alaska Native corporations are such a huge part of Alaska and Anchorage's economy. Can you tell us a little bit about what you think the biggest opportunities are for village corporations to grow and thrive over the next few years and what impact that's going to have on Anchorage?
Well, thank you, John. Many of us in the last recent few years have been celebrating 50 years since the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. You hear the gas line being talked about now. Imagine back in 1971, we weren't businesses yet. And we didn't have subsidiaries, we didn't own companies, we didn't have heavy equipment. Today, we can actually participate in major developments within Alaska. Many of our corporate headquarters now are based here in Anchorage. We own buildings, we buy businesses. AIH, the hardware store, was bought by a Native corporation. Brown Jug, we reinvest a lot of the capital that we make back into the state. I believe we are very close to being one of the largest employers based in Alaska, with many of those here in Anchorage and some in Mat-Su. A lot of diversity. We work very well. We represent right now 176 village corporations. We have a 9-member board. You have to be a CEO to be on our board. We have members that are now doing over $1 billion in revenue. And we have a lot of small folks that are still struggling in other parts of Alaska. But we've been investing here in Anchorage since 1971. And, you know, I don't only stand up here as a shareholder of a corporation, I'm also a tribal member. So most of us who are shareholders also are affiliated with our tribes. And our tribes are growing. My tribe, Clinton Heights Central Council, never would I have guessed 30 years ago when I worked with them, that we'd have offices based in Southeast Alaska, but we now have offices in Anchorage, in the Siri building and just down the road. So government contracting, although that has been a challenge in with this administration, we talk about J-Bear. Many of us have construction companies, electricians, mechanical companies that are helping build the infrastructure on J-Bear and a lot of the other bases. And then you have a lot of the regions, like from Fairbanks. I see my friends at Chilista here. You know, Chilista bought a Bryce Construction, a well-known family contractor from Fairbanks. They're now also having offices here in Anchorage. So we're very bullish on the future. And then there's another generation. I'm the second generation of ANGSCA that's working for the corporation, class of 84, X generation, still young. But we see a new generation coming up, and it's incredible to see how many lawyers and doctors and engineers that are coming up. Some of our corporations have opened up our books to a new generation. I don't like the word left behinds, but that's, if you were born after 1971, you weren't a shareholder unless you're gifted shares, like I did with my kids. But a lot of our corporations are opening up those books for a new classification of shares, also recognizing we have a bright future, and our future needs to be invested in our young professionals coming up. And there's a huge generation coming up. And then I see so many friends and faces in here, what we employ for services, you know, the BDOs that have accounts with us and a lot of other companies. We bring a lot to this economy, and most of it is based here out of Anchorage.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us today on Addressing Alaskans. We just heard speakers from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation's 2026 Economic Luncheon. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ammon Swenson. Thanks for listening.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.